Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the GlobalX Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hell, I can't hit the side of a barn. There's no sport in it for a guy who can shoot straight. The sport comes when somebody like me has to pull up behind him and start shooting to find out where the bullets are going, like spraying flowers with a garden hose. That was Lieutenant Colonel Don Blakesley of the 4th Fighter Group joining us on the...
He didn't sound anything like that.
What did he sound like then, Jim? Hell, I can't
He was much more gravelly.
Okay. Growl. Hell, I can't hit the side of a barn. There's no sport in it for a guy who can shoot straight. Sport comes when somebody like me has to pull up behind him and start shooting to find out where the bullets are going, like spraying flowers with a garden hose. More like that.
Yeah, much better.
Okay, yeah. So that was Lieutenant Colonel.
That's much more the vibe, although he's only 27 at that point.
Oh, right, okay. Well, yeah, but he's also a fighter pilot, so maybe he's...
Well, he's an absolute dude. I mean, he's one of my great heroes from the Second World War, Don Blakesley. He was a no-nonsense, no-mincing-about, absolute gung-ho, loved air fighting, loved flying, loved being in fighter planes, loved shooting down Germans, Huns... square jawed, piercing blue eyes, unbelievably good looking. You know, when you imagine your kind of sort of archetypal kind of, no, when Hollywood imagines its archetypal kind of American fighter pilot, Don Blakesley's your man. This is the guy. He's just tough as boots and just completely brilliant.
So welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. James Holland and I will engage in homoerotic fantasies about American fighter pilots for the next hour.
I have got a bit of a thing for these guys, I have to say. The 4th Fighter Group has always touched me.
Well, I didn't know what it would do for anyone.
Not physically.
Dropping their breakfast, sputtering on their croissant right now.
Well, it's Mustangs and Spitfires and Thunderbolts, isn't it? You know.
Well, welcome to the latest part of our... well, we're not cantering through this. Actually, what's quite good about this is we're taking our time.
We're taking it quite leisurely, aren't we? We're doing it in some detail, and that's good.
The campaign of the Mighty 8th, the US 8th Army Air Force, and their bombing campaign is what we've been talking about up till now. And we've talked about the struggle to reconcile concept with practice.
Yes.
And simple things like to digest the fact that the weather over Europe is not like the weather... over the United States of America.
Yes, all of that. I mean, all of that.
Whose weather's normal in this situation? And the fact that the pursuit fighter will try... I think this comes back to the ancient adage, the enemy gets a vote. And the bomber mafia people thought that they had found a way to negate the enemy's vote. But as Claire Chennault said, the bomber is going to be the first ever weapon to which the enemy doesn't try and find a response. I'm paraphrasing from the other day. And we, in the last episode, we talked about how really that the time of the escort fighter was surely coming. And so here it is.
Well, yes. And I think it's interesting, you know, when we're talking about the Mighty Eight, people almost always think of B-17s and B-24s and those bomber streams and this silvery aluminum ships kind of going across the sky with contrails behind them and all the rest of it. And you think of the bombers. It's really a bomber war. And obviously Masters of the Air is focusing on the bombers. And yet it actually, the key to the Eighth and how they develop and grow is the pursuit plane, the fighter plane, rather than the bomber. And what the American commanders, Ira Aker and others, start to realize after Schweinfurt won, actually, is, and even before that, arguably, is that actually, no, in fact, actually before that, because you can see in the rhetoric that Aker's saying, you know, that we know that the enemy's fighter force is growing and all the rest of it. He's starting, they're already, the warning bells are going in the first 6 months of 1943. Those warning bells have come home to roost in a horrific way in the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid of 17th of August, 1943, and then the massed bomber operations of the first and second week of October 1943, which culminated on the Thursday, the 14th, Black Thursday. I think it's really important when we're telling the story of the 8th Air Force to really spell out why fighters are important, who they were, and what they need to do about it. Because actually fighters, the crisis, and we've called this episode 3 crisis, the crisis at the heart of the 8th Air Force in the autumn, the fall of 1943, is what to do about the fighter problem and unescorted bombers. And that's the nub of the matter.
Because the truth is, the concept they thought would work doesn't, which is bombers being self-protecting and flying in protected sort of wagon trains, basically. And the idea is that they protect themselves with their arcs of fire, and they're chucking out so much lead that it's too dangerous for a German fighter to come near them. And the problem is this hasn't survived contact with reality, but they're yet to make the conceptual leap, aren't they, really, to the idea of the pursuit plane. Because the pursuit plane, I mean, it's quite interesting, because the British call them fighter planes, which doesn't necessarily immediately make you think they're a defensive weapon. The name is a very interesting distinction. The Americans call them pursuit planes. If you're pursuing someone, you're chasing after them. You're defending yourself, aren't you? And the conceptual leap that the Americans have to make is to turn what they regard as pursuit planes actually into attack aircraft, to make them part of the offensive.
Yes, and they do. They're starting to do that, and they're calling them fighter groups and fighter squadrons rather than pursuit squadrons.
Yeah, which is really, really interesting, isn't it? Because that it takes this long is actually part of the tragedy of the U.S. 8th Air Force's campaign. The technology's always been there; it's always been available to them. They've experimented with drop tanks in the 1920s. They realize that they don't necessarily reduce the performance of an aircraft. All this sort of stuff, but they put it to one side. They just forget about it. Anyway,
let's have a look at the fighter. Let's have a look at who they are and what they've got in the beginning of October 1940, middle of October 1943. You know, who are these fighter groups? Because they're less in number, fewer in number than the bomber groups. And you know, I think it's really important to make absolutely clear that there is nothing wrong with the quality of the air crews that are coming over from the USA at all for the bombers. The issue is that they're being decimated by German fighter pilots who, paradoxically, are qualitatively far inferior to the American fighter equivalents. That is the paradox. US fighter pilots are incredibly good, as are RAF fighter pilots at this time. You know, all of them are reaching, you know, there is not a single American fighter pilot who is reaching UK shores at this time without at least 350 hours in their logbooks. So compare that to RAF Fighter Command and Luftwaffe fighter pilots in 1940, which are reaching their squadrons with about, you know, 170 hours,
yeah,
something like that.
Although by the Battle of Britain, the Luftwaffe guys have got more time in the logbooks, haven't they? Because they've been doing that.
Well, some of them have, yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about, you know, if you're a new guy and you're reaching the Luftwaffe in say, August 1940, you would have 170 hours. Obviously, if you're Adolf Galland, you've got zillions because you've, you know, been flying since you were knee-high to a grasshopper, and then you've been to Spain, then you've been to Poland, then you've been to, you know, done everything. But yes, but if you're a new guy, and that is about 150 hours plus 20 hours on type, you know, so Spitfire, Messerschmitt 109, whatever. So 350 hours is a lot, and that is a considerable number on your Mustang or, you know, Thunderbolt or P-40 or whatever it is. And the other thing about it is that the training is consistent. So one of the problems for pilots training in UK or in Germany, because of the weather and because of the wintry conditions that you get, you know, half the year, you know, you might have days where you can't fly. Whereas in the United States, you've got your guaranteed sun in Florida, Texas, you know, wherever it might be, all year round, which means you can, there's a consistency about the training, which means every single day you know you're going to be flying, which means you don't forget stuff. It means you can sort of build much more quickly. But it also means that you can process more pilots much more quickly.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
you've got 365 days of the year in which you can potentially train pilots. So all of that is a huge, huge advantage.
And also there isn't the possibility that where your training might be attacked, that there might be enemy aircraft in your airspace from time to time. You know, the simple advantages that the Allies enjoy in the fact that America is untouched and untouchable, the American continent, because after all, the British run a large portion of their pilot training, flight crew training in Canada, don't they? So you know, that simple advantage and the weather, like you say, means that people are up all day, every day, rather than, it's still as dangerous. There are still lots and lots of accidents. And I think it's striking. Is it 5,000 or 6,000? I can't remember. 8th Air Force personnel are killed in accidents.
Although for proportionally slightly less than they are in say, RAF in the UK, because you haven't got sort of, you know, Snowdon and mountains and moors and stuff. You know, you can train where there's pretty flat land and, you know, you've got so much space in which to kind of twiddle around the sky in a way that you just don't in the UK, which is obviously a small country, and you're competing with airspace with operational crews and aircraft, you know. So you just don't have any of those issues. So whichever way you look at it, it's just a huge, huge, huge advantage. And it means that by the time they get over here, they're pretty good already. And what it means is that when a new pilot gets to England to join, let's say, the 4th Fighter Group or the 56th Fighter Group, whatever it is, they no longer have to be thinking about how to fly. They just have to concentrate about how to become a decent fighter pilot, which is not obviously the same thing. And, you know, in terms of personnel, they're definitely higher up the food chain than a lot of other units. You know, the cream tend to go to become fighters. And they also, unlike the 8th Bomber Command, 8th Fighter Command, the fighter wing of the 8th Air Force, has a hard core of veterans that they can spread through their ranks, because lots of them have already been flying operationally for the RAF.
Yeah.
And, you know, Hub Zemke, for example, is a, you know, it's worth just sort of highlighting a few of these characters. So take Hub Zemke, for example, Hubert Zemke. He's a sports scholar at university. He joins the United States Army Air Corps as a cadet in 1936, gains his wings, then went on a pursuit pilot course, sent to England in 1940 as an observer, then to the Soviet Union as a fighter pilot instructor on Lend-Lease P-40s, makes his way back to the US via Iran and Egypt, joins the United States Army Air Force, and becomes commander of the new unit that's been specially formed, the 56th Fighter Group. And he spends much of his time developing new tactics for the P-47 when that's coming in, making the most of its, you know, so he's basically flying and flying and flying it.
Yeah.
And going, okay, what can this kite do? What can't it do? What's it good at? What's it not good at?
It's a brick shit house, so yes. I will fly it accordingly, basically.
Yeah, but he's got the experience and hours and knowledge, intense, deep knowledge of combat flying and of small aircraft, you know, single wing, single engine aircraft flying, to be able to take this plane up into the air and work out what its characteristics are and how that can be best adapted to the job in hand. And he says, a fighter pilot must possess an inner urge to do combat. The will at all times to be offensive will develop into his own tactics. And the other big mantra he has for P-47s is dive, fire, and recover. Because the P-47 can dive better than anything else. And, you know, I do think he's quite Basball, which for anyone who doesn't understand cricket won't know what I'm talking about. But basically, this is a
play to win.
The idea is to take away the fear, is to instill confidence and to encourage people to operate at the best of their ability and aggressively. So he's very inspirational. He's very good at giving confidence to everybody. Listens to even the lowliest pilot who's just turned over, just arrived in the UK. And the 56th Fighter Group becomes known as Zemke's Wolf Pack. And in October 1943, while 8th Bomber Command are having their kind of, you know, month Total misery. Yeah, I'm trying to be Latin and clever, but it doesn't work. But having their horror month.
Monatus miserabilis.
Yes, that's exactly what I was after. In October, Zemke's wolf pack shoots down 39 enemy aircraft, the loss of one of their own.
That's pretty good going, isn't it?
That's pretty good going. And so there just isn't the same level of sort of rookiness that there is in the US Army, for example, in the first part of 1943.
And they're not gripped by gloom, are they?
And they're not gripped by gloom. No, they most certainly are not. These guys, the contrast is just so huge. You know, that these guys are super confident, absolutely gunning for it, know what they're about, know they've got superior aircraft, know they've got superior skills, and, you know, have the kind of swagger that goes with it. You know, the hardcore of 8th Fighter Command, when it is formed in the summer of 1942, you know, it's a pretty finished article already, because running through it is this seam of extremely experienced pilots with, you know, 1,000-hour-plus logbooks.
And a lot of this comes from the Eagle Squadrons, which I think is really interesting as a sort of minor digression.
No, well, I think we should digress on that. I think it's really important.
Basically, three squadrons, by the time it's done, of volunteers from the US who aren't waiting for the war to start for America and come to the UK. And between September 1940 and July 1941, these squadrons are formed, and they become... You know, they operate, all three are involved in the Dieppe raid. They're as much part of Fighter Command of the Rhubarbs and all the sweeps and all that stuff, the post-Battle of Britain stuff, really, as anybody else. And they're RAF personnel. They're sort of gobbled up completely by the Royal Air Force, which I think is really, 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 really interesting.
And those three squadrons become the heart of the 4th Fighter Group.
Yeah, exactly. And it's 71, 121, 133.
Well, let's have a look at one of those, you know, and that is Don Blakesley. You know, who we quoted at the top, and I was slightly going the horn for. But I mean, he's absolutely one of those guys. You know, he's one of the volunteers who goes up to Canada, joins the RCAF, the Royal Canadian Air Force, flies over to gets a ship over to England, joins 133 Squadron, that one of the Eagle Squadrons.
Motto: Let us to the battle.
Right. It's you know, enough said. I mean, it tells you everything you need to know. And by the summer of 1942, a lot of those 133 squadron pilots are due to be rotated back, including the CO, who's a chap called Red McCulpin. But they then have this absolute catastrophe, because on an escort mission to France, they run into an excessive headwinds on the way back. And 11 of the 12 are lost. They just end up in the channel, including McCulpin. So obviously, you know, you would have kind of 22, 24 pilots for 12 airborne. So there's still quite enough left, but that is half the squadron just gone in one mission. And Blakesley is told to take over, and they know they're about to be transformed into the 4th Fighter Group. But that night, he calls everyone into the bar, buys them all drinks, tells them all the drinks on him, gets them all absolutely shit-faced. And then as he turns to leave them all that night, says, right, you've all got to be ready at 6 a.m. the following morning. And everyone kind of sort of slightly gulps. And the next morning, he tells them all to take off together. Now, you know, on a grosse effort, what you would normally do is sort of fly off in a vic of three or possibly four racing across, but you don't have kind of 16 of them kind of taking off. But he's absolutely non-negotiable on this. And he goes, you know, yelling at them to tighten up and show the bastards. And what he means is, the other two Eagle Squadrons who are based at Debden, because 133 Squadron is at Great Samford, which is a satellite of Debden. And everyone's so kind of, you know, the other pilots are so shocked by this that they all absolutely kind of sober up immediately, wake up and absolutely do exactly what he says. And they fly in perfect formation at 500 feet over Debden. And as Jim Goodson, who was one of those pilots in 133 Squadron, who had been at the bar the night before, says, that evening, Blakesley wasn't the only 133 pilot with belligerent swagger. So it's certainly an unorthodox way of going about things, but it absolutely does the trick.
That's proper leading from the front, you know, we're all in this together leadership, exactly. Isn't it? You know. Yeah.
It's setting out his stall. It's setting. It's saying, I'm going to do things like this. You know,
they're escorting American fortresses on that, the raid where they come back and lose 12 people in the headwind, aren't they? So, yeah. Or 11 out of the 12. It's really interesting that, isn't it? So they are already involved in escorting American bombers. So then they get turned into 336. Again, I just love the Americans. The numbers are all bigger. Just from the off. But, you know.
133, let's add a couple of hundred.
Yeah, 133. No, you're 336 now. So quickly they get turned around. And I think it's obviously the RAF probably have no option but to surrender this squadron of pilots, do they?
Yes, and they paint off the rondels and put in the kind of American star on their Spitfires. And Blakesley's really happy about this. He loves Spitfires. You know, this is what he likes, a sort of thoroughbred. So he gets very pissed off when they transfer to P-47s instead.
And 336 still exist. The Rocketeers. So they've traded in Letters to the Battle, which is a bit more sort of RAF and demure, for Rocketeers. So you could argue that there's your cultural difference straight there. But he loves fighting. We love fighting. Fighting is a grand sport.
And he leads from the front. You know, that's the point. You know, he's only interested in people who want to take action, take the fight to the enemy. You know, he's aggressive, confident, instills confidence in everyone else. Everyone wants to kind of follow him. He's just a natural leader of men. And the amazing thing is, you know, he's been glib about the barn door thing. I mean, you know, he's a much better shot than he's giving himself credit for. He can't do deflection shooting, but that's okay. He just goes up.
The leadership is the point. And although he's the XO, he carries on flying combat, which shows he's doing that thing of, you know, I'm not going to ask you to do anything that I'm not prepared to do myself.
Yeah, but he absolutely loves it. He's an adrenaline junkie. You know, he's the kind of sort of guy that's going to parachute off Everest. I mean, you know, he can't get enough of it. He just loves flying and he loves shooting down Huns. I mean,
if you're an Eagle Squadron qualified pilot and you go to the US Air Force, you Army Air Force, you retain your wings, but you're allowed to wear smaller wings, and that counts as an American. The Army Air Force go, all right, okay, you are a pilot, it's fine, you're qualified, you don't need to qualify. But they all wear, the Eagle Squadron guys all wear small RAF wings on their uniforms as a sort of
that's right.
As a calling card, basically.
It's worth mentioning a couple of others, I think, because I think that, you know, these are just, they're different, but they're interesting characters. So another one is Captain Dwayne B. Beeson, who's 22 in 1943. He's from Boise,
Idaho.
Oh, Boise, Idaho. And he was going to become a lawyer, but decides he wants to become a pilot instead. So he goes to Canada, joins the RCAF, ends up in the Eagle Squadrons. He's quite the opposite of Blakesley. You know, he's fastidious. Sees flying as a science. He says that in the RAF, he was always spoiling to go out and kill Germans, having picked up an unaccountable Hun phobia somewhere along the line. You know, that's the sort of line that's written by the PR, the four fighter group PR officer. And of course, it says much about the four fighter group and the way that these boys are, these units are set up, that they do have their own PR officers. And, you know, he just wants to get better and better. There's no complacency about Beeson whatsoever. You know, he practices deflection shooting all the time using a homemade gunnery gadget. And he's a great student of warfare. You know, he reads a lot about the earlier races. You know, he really analyzes it. And he becomes the 4th Fighter Group's first ace on the 8th of October, 1943. Another of the characters is John Gentile, who writes, you know, I can't remember the time when airplanes were not part of my life, and can't remember ever wanting anything so much as to fly one. So as a boy, as a teenager, he stays up with a friend and buys an absolute wreck. Unfortunately, his father comes to his rescue and gets it checked out, and they realize that it's an absolute death trap. And this guy, both he and his friend, have been completely ripped off. His father stops him flying, but then eventually helps him get an aircraft later on when he's a little bit older and wiser. And, you know, he's very dashing. He's very good looking. He's from Italian stock and known as Gentle. And he's just a superb pilot. Again, like Blakesley, he's an adrenaline junkie. He just loves it. He can't get enough of it. He just wants to go faster and faster and faster.
But he is a superb pilot, but he's had the opportunity to discover that because the training's proper and in depth and all that. So, I mean, that's one of the things I think is really striking about this. Is I imagine there were plenty of superb pilots who went into the German training scheme, but they just never got the opportunity to become them.
Well, also, there's not a culture of nurturing in the Luftwaffe in the way that there is in the United States Army Air Force and in 8th Fighter Command, where it is absolutely drummed into all of them that when new guys come, it is your job to kind of make them really good too. You know, we're all in it together and everyone wants to become an ace. Whereas in Luftwaffe's fighter groups, it's all about the expert, and it's all about the experts, the guys of the Knight's Cross who've got 25 victories. And the job of the rest of the fighter pilots is to further their score and further enhance them as a kind of sort of unique standout individual. That's not how it is. And to kind of ram home that point, one of the flight commanders, Captain Spike Miley, is rotated back home in October 1943, and Gentile takes over from him. And Miley takes him to one side before he ships out and says, all right, you know, you're red hot and it's natural you should want to be a firecracker. But you've got boys following you now who have things to learn before they get red hot. They're going to follow you wherever you take them. Remember that whenever you take them anywhere, remember that whenever you take them anywhere, it's not only your brains that are going to get knocked out, but the brains of the kids who are depending on you. And Gentile takes this advice to heart. And it's very much part of the 8-Fighter Command ethos, that young pilots arriving with plenty of flying skill need to be brought up to pace as fighter pilots, and they're nurtured. And that is so different from the Luftwaffe way of doing things.
Yeah. But I mean, this is what's interesting, isn't it? Is that there is a system in place to nurture people and encourage them. Who knows if they ever would have been brilliant pilots, but the system's able to find them, able to give them time. I mean, I think the fact that someone has hundreds of hours in their logbook, it's critically important as a difference.
It so is.
And flying a fighter plane, and obviously flying in a bomber is incredibly physically rigorous because it's really, really, really cold. You need your oxygen, you need proper air. So if you fly to Schweinfurt and back and you survive, you've been on oxygen basically for 9/10 of that flight, haven't you? The minute they're at altitude, on it goes. If they've got themselves one of those suits that warms them up, then lucky them. It may break down. You need to go to the toilet. If you end up going to the toilet in your uniform, it'll freeze. It might, you know, if you take your gloves off and touch the metal, it'll take the skin off your hands. And on and on and on. Anyone comes at shooting at you. If you're a fighter pilot, you're putting your body through far more in terms of G, in terms of, you know, the cold and the stress and all that of flying the aircraft and the altitude you're flying at and the speed you're flying at are all incredibly physically demanding in a different way to being a tail gunner who's sort of sat there an awful long time trying to concentrate, peering out the window, basically.
Yeah.
Stay warm, keep his mind together and all that. And you're being decisive and you need to be physically capable of being decisive. So, I mean, you know, if you meet modern fighter pilots, unfortunately, this is sort of Top Gun, isn't it? I mean, it is called square jawed guys who play beach volleyball.
Volleyball and look ripped. Yeah, no, it is a bit like that. I mean, but it is noticeable that these guys are. It is a small thing, but they are incredibly healthy, because flying a fighter plane is different from flying a B-17, but it is still mentally and physically incredibly demanding. So you need to be fit. You need to be well fed. You need to be physically strong, and these guys all are. Again, that's a little 5% thing, but five, you know, percentages are absolutely vital. I think the key thing here is that, you know, you've got your 350 hours in your logbook, you're arriving over in England, no one is expecting you to fly to Bremen the next day. So what happens is, you know, because there's 45 pilots in a squadron, to have 16 airborne at any one moment, there, you know, by this stage there's no longer 12s, it's 16 for flights of, you know, fours, and four flights of four, you know, in the old finger four formation that the Germans use, and which is much more useful when you're attacking, by the way. You know, a Vic is much better for a defensive formation, but the swarm, the finger four, is much better for and it's called a finger four because if you hold out your hand, you've got two fingers which are slightly ahead of the other two, and it's done in that kind of
one pattern. Off on the corner,
right, exactly. And that new guy will be taken up into the air for practice training flights first. You know, no one's just going to send him over to the channel before he's ready. And, you know, Don Gentile might take him up and show him a few tricks and you know, see if he can get on my tail, son, and all that kind of stuff, and learn some ropes. And he'll have a week or so of doing that. Then the first operational mission he does will be a milk run. You know, it'll be a kind of just a channel hop or something. And so you're easing these guys into it. You know, the contrast of the Luftwaffe by October 1943 could not be more stark, because you're in, you're flying, the next day you're kind of attacking, you know, flying fortresses, you know, over Hamelin or Munster or whatever.
And you're attacking them head on.
And you're attacking them head on. You've got no experience. And you know, in your logbooks, you're lucky if you've got three figures, you know, if you've got 100 hours. So it's so different. So there is this huge qualitative gulf between what 8 Fighter Command can bring to the party and what the Luftwaffe can bring to the party. The problem is they can't get in amongst them very well. And so this is the big problem in October 1943, that you've got really superior fighter pilots in the Mighty 8 who can't do what they need to do.
Yeah, they can't get
And
there.
You've got bombers which need to destroy the Luftwaffe and need to destroy the German aircraft industry, but can't effectively reach those targets because whenever they do, they get decimated. So clearly the answer is to bring those fighter pilots into the battle, all the way to Regensburg, all the way to Wiener Neustadt, all the way to Munster and Halberstadt and Bremen and all the rest of it. But how do you do that? That is the problem. That is the crisis, and that is the dilemma that's facing.
And because of Overlord, because you need the skies clear, you're escorting is a defensive posture. You're changing escort from a defensive to an offensive posture. You've got the pilots to do it. You've got the aircraft to do it. You can't get the aircraft there because you need to invent something that will possibly. What could it be? We'll be back after the break to explain how MDF saved the world. We'll see you in a tick.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Just wanted to give you a moment there without any dodgy American accents. So,
I think you should bring them back immediately.
So we are in part two. Adolf Hitler.
Continues.
I mean, Adolf Hitler implies the existence of a Beedolf Hitler and then a Seedolf Hitler.
In a time of war.
So what we've done there is we've sort of analysed essentially the weapon that is available to the US 8th Army Air Force.
But can't be brought to bear. That's the point. That's the frustration.
They're still going out. The daylight bombing, I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because they do try some, there's a point at which the 8th do try some night bombing, isn't there? They have a go.
A little bit.
A little bit. And they don't lose lots of crews and everything, but they still aren't convinced. I have to say... I mean, this is a story about how powerful ideology can be.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
What a grip.
Going to be deterred off this path. I'm going to keep going.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't dissuade me.
And this sort of thing that it's not that the idea is wrong. We just haven't applied it right yet, which is such an interesting mindset. And
well, and they're not entirely wrong either.
Yeah, but they're not entirely right. And they're chewing through crews.
Yes.
They? Yeah. And this anyway.
But it also underlines, doesn't it, how new it is, how new this technology is, how new this type of warfare is, how new the United States are to kind of being a global military power. I mean, that's the other point to consider. I mean, here we are in October 1943, and you know, the first bomber mission by the Mighty Eighth is only the previous August.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
in
yeah.
the middle of that is a hiatus of diverting lots of their a lot of their crews and aircraft to North Africa. So,
and the war in Northwest Europe has what? Only 18 months left to run. I mean,
That's the bit they don't know. But it's worth, isn't it, mentioning that you know, despite the catastrophe of October, you know, they're still going out every night, but not really deep into the Reich anymore. And that's the problem, because it is going into the Reich, which is where the point blank targets are. And for those who haven't listened to the earlier one, point blank is the directive given. It's the main mission of the Mighty Eighth at this time, which is to destroy the German aircraft industry. That's their priority target. And they're just not able to do it. So 11th of November, 347 bombers attack Munster.
has to be abandoned because of bad weather. Only 59 make it. 13th of November, 272 planes scheduled to hit Bremen, but only 143 reach target. Again, bad weather is the problem. The weather in November is consistently awful. 16th of November, 189 dispatched, but only 130 fly to Narbonne. 18th of November, 102 dispatched. You know, not big numbers, are they? To Oslo this time, but only 82 actually get there. 19th of November, 167 scheduled, 130 only fly to the German-Dutch border. So, you know, and so on and so on.
Are they using H2X by this point? Because
yes, they are. Yeah.
One of the things I think is really interesting about the obviously, so H2X, for those who don't know, is the American version of H2S, which is the downward-looking radar that the RAF Bomber Command have perfected. If you look at a Lancaster, there's a sort of half an egg on its underside shape.
That's right. Yes.
And it's as simple as a radar that points downwards and gives you a rough map on a cathode ray tube of the ground below, because water is flat and so reflects the signal straight back at you, and the earth is all disrupted. Ground, you know, landscape is disrupted. So you get, that's how it creates a picture.
It's effectively ground mapping radar.
Ground mapping radar, but the, you know, very first kind. And what it's really, really good for is finding somewhere like Hamburg, because it's on the coast and you get a very, very, you get a very, very clear image if there's water. So you can fly, you know, you can find the Rhine, you can find the Ruhr, you can use it to map read. And at this point, Acre has, it's very, very interesting because Harris resists the Pathfinder thing in Bomber Command, tooth and nail, and then gives into it. And then it becomes a really effective way of delivering the bomber stream to its target. With, you know, planes going in first, they find the target, they go in first, they mark it with what they call Christmas tree lights, Germans call Christmas tree lights, and drop incendiaries, mark coloured incendiaries on the target or as close as they can, and then everyone bombs to that. And because the Americans have switched to this idea that the lead bombardier flies the aircraft with the autopilot, they're experimenting with Pathfinders and H2X. So because the truth is, you are bombing through cloud all the time over Northwest Europe. And the Americans have to reconcile themselves to the fact they can't do precision bombing. So Acre's given in, and he has Pathfinders, he has H2X. However, I mean, I think one of the really interesting things about this is that people send not their best crews from their squadrons to train on the H2X because they don't rate it. So they don't send their best people. They don't trust it. And they also don't like the fact, the American crews don't like the fact that it's essentially an admission that you're bombing through cloud and that you're blind bombing, that you're area bombing like the British. And so, yes, they've got H2X. Yes, they have a way of finding their way to the target. But no, they're not necessarily using it to their best advantage. And I think that's because we were talking about ideology before the break. The pilots believe in this ideology that they're bombing precision, they're not killing civilians, that they're not doing what the British are doing, which is the British going, well, you know, that actually, and this is born of the technology not being there yet. So there's this interesting contrast where the technology is improving to the point where the British don't need to area bomb anymore, not strictly speaking. And the Americans are faced with the circumstances where they have to area bomb because the technology isn't up to bombing them, getting them through bad weather and delivering them on target.
Yes, it's these two opposite views, and they're sort of meeting in the middle.
They're sort of meeting
they?
In the middle.
And that is a really interesting. I think it's really
They're using the same aids because the Americans are using Oboe as well, aren't they? They're using the same aids that Bomber Command of it. So I think what's really interesting, again, there's an awful lot of Allied cooperation. They've got the access to the same resources. You know, it's really interesting in Don Miller's book, The Mighty Eighth, that H2X is in it, but it's really mentioned in passing. And yet, if you read a Bomber Command history, H2X is absolutely central to the story.
Well, it's all about the striving to improve the navigational aids. I mean, that's one of the reasons why Harris doesn't launch his all-out offensive till 6th of March 1943, having taken over in February 1942, so 13 months earlier, because he doesn't think stuff's ready. And he knows this stuff is coming online, but it's just not there yet. And he doesn't want to do it until he can be more effective, you know, when he's got more bombers, more and better means of targeting the targets that he's going for.
But you have this feeling amongst the American bomber crews. It's really, really interesting that they're going, we don't kill civilians. This isn't what we do. So these raids where they can't get to Munster, where they're bombing blind, where the weather's bad, are also bad for morale.
When morale is already bad.
when morale's really bad, because they seem to be running fundamentally counter for the war they think they've come to Britain to fight.
And that's a devastating moment, isn't it? That realization is devastating.
Yeah. It's really, 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 really devastating moment for them. And they're going into the winter, bombing blind. And the truth is, you know, it's something like there's two clear days weather in the whole of the winter of 1950s. They've got to do this, or they sit on their hands and don't go.
Well, they've got to do it because the clock is ticking and they need to clear the airspace before the cross-channel invasion. And everyone is getting, you know, the tension is ratcheting up. I mean, obviously, the senior commanders are hiding this particular aspect from the air crews. But even so, it is that pressure is filtering down, the pressure to do things. And I think the scale of the slaughter has shocked everybody. And of course, it's really, really tough on the crews because you come back from a mission, suddenly, you know, they're in your Quonset hut where you had kind of, you know, maybe, you know, four crews in one Quonset hut. You know, half the beds are empty suddenly, where that morning they were full. And that's really difficult. And there's a very good diary that's kept by Major James Good Brown, who is the chaplain of the 381st Bomb Group, which is at Ridgewell in Essex. And there's still lots of it still left, actually. It's a great airfield to visit. But by the beginning of December, he notes what a massive change has come over the men of the group. And he says, the replacements come into the group as strangers, and they feel distant. No matter what one does, they feel somewhat lost. There's no way of getting around this difficulty because they were not members of the 381st during the long months of training back in the States when, you know, obviously the bomb group is formed. So they don't have that bond. The new crews know, too, that they are not part of the original group. They know also that they may go down in combat. This was not true of the original group. Not a single man expected to be shot down. We were innocent. We did not know war. That is why we hung together like a bunch of dead-end kids. We hung together in desperation. As each man went down, we clung tighter. We could not believe what was happening. Each loss came to us as a shock. When we had the bottom shot out of us this past summer, it was a deadening blow. Only those here at the time can fully experience what happened on this base. Then, when one day this fall, the same thing happened, taking away the last half, i.e. this is the October bit, the half that was on its way completing 25 missions, it nearly killed us. As for comradeship, this was no more, for our comrades had gone. You know, and that's pretty devastating, isn't it? So what that means is morale has been shot to pieces. None of the originals left. New guys are coming in. They feel strangers. They don't feel bonded. The crews might feel bonded, but it's hard to bond with other crews because there's a kind of wariness and distance about that because you don't want to become friends with someone who's going to be shot down on the next mission. And it's winter, and it's dark, and it's freezing cold, and the conditions are miserable, and they don't feel like they're achieving anything.
Yeah.
And it's catastrophic, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's... this balancing act of keeping morale going, keeping the campaign going. I mean, you wonder if they'd been going into a summer and the bombing were able to be, obviously the bad weather is good because it grounds fighters and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It helps in that regard. You wonder if they were going into a summer, how, if they were going into another really, really, really bad time ahead of them, what would have happened to their morale? Whether morale doesn't collapse. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary. And again, you know, both bomber campaigns as part of the combined bomber offensive, the morale doesn't collapse and they keep going. I think it's the most extraordinary thing. And obviously,
but it's on the point of collapsing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's pretty close. And of course, this is all coinciding with the transformation of the air defense system over the Reich.
With this
following Operation Gomorrah, the bombing of Hamburg, that the Germans have kind of sort of kicked the old system into touch and they're now getting much better and they've got this proper kind of air defense system. I mean, having said that, you know, new bomb groups are still arriving, and not least the 445th Bomb Group, part of the new 2nd Division, which is just equipped with B-24 Liberators. And it's the 703rd Bomb Squadron of the 445th, for example, that's commanded by Jimmy Stewart, the film star.
Yeah.
So he's coming over at this time, you know, and he's commanding a squadron and doing his bit and going into battle and all the rest of it. But
Clark Gable's a gunner, isn't he, at this point?
Yeah, he's a waist gunner.
That's right, which is just amazing.
Yeah. However, it has to be said that by this time, by kind of sort of November 1943, there absolutely is a solution to the problem that the Mighty Eight finds itself in. This is how to get a long-range fighter to escort the bombers all the way deep into the Reich and back. It's just whether this is going to kind of sort of arrive in time. So I think the moment has arrived to look at the Mustang.
Well,
one of the great planes.
I mean, the thing is if you're a regular listener to this podcast, you've heard us perv on Mustangs a lot. And it is, of course, like many great inventions, it's ended up doing something it wasn't designed for at all. It's the greatest American aircraft ever made that the Americans weren't interested in when it was commissioned. They thought they didn't really rate it. It's designed by a German, basically.
it's Edgar Schmood.
It's all these sort of, it's quite extraordinary. So the background is...
Very briefly.
Well, yeah. Outbreak Second World War, British and French think we need a load of planes all of a sudden. Yep. And the Americans are saying, well, we can make loads of planes. Don't you worry about it. And we'll happily take your folding money for it. Thank you very much. And so the Anglo-French Purchasing Board in 1940, February, order a fighter aircraft. 120 days is the turnaround. They do the prototype in 117. The order's approved. 4th of May, 1940, for 320. And it's a great... The engine's crap is what it comes down to, isn't it?
Yes, because all great aircrafts are a marriage of engine and airframe. And the airframe of the Mustang is of the P-51. The Mustang, as the British call it, is stupendously good. And ergonomically, it's very good. It's very efficient in terms of construction time, how it's made. It's nothing like as complex as a Hurricane or a Spitfire to make. It has all sorts of interesting, unique aerodynamic designs features to it, the aerofoil wing, the fact that the air intake is much further back and actually creates a sort of effective, what is effectively jet thrust out of the back of it, which, you know, all of which is incredibly good. It's $30,000 cheaper to make than a P-47. And, you know, that doesn't sound like a lot for a fighter plane, but it's a huge amount in 1943. So all of which is good. It is just the Allison V-1710, which is not really
it's terrible.
It's terrible. It's not very good. And the big problem is that the V-1710 is not very good at height. So it's absolutely fine under 10,000 feet, but it's not above that. And obviously a fighter plane, an escort plane, needs to operate at very high altitude. And so that's a major problem.
But the RAF are taking it in terms of it's a fighter plane that they have, and they'll roll it. They'll find a role for it, is what they've done. But the problem is, you know, ME-109s, FW-190s are around, and it's just not, literally not keeping up with the competition. But fortunately, the way it's designed, the way it's built, is there's room in it for a Merlin.
Well, it is, and it's really interesting because I was up at Rolls-Royce with Roland White, and we were looking at this. And when you look at the Allison V-1710, and you compare it to a Merlin 10, you can see the size is basically the same. What you haven't got is you haven't got the supercharger on the V-1710, which is a big problem. That is the issue for it. And that's why it's not very good above 10,000 feet. But it's a longer engine than the Merlin. But when you put the Merlin with its supercharger side by side with the V-1710, it takes pretty much the same space in an engine cowling, which means it can slot straight into a Merlin. And this is spotted by Ron Harker, who's the chief test pilot at Rolls-Royce, and he recognises that the airframe of the Mustang is stupendously good and wonders what will happen if you put a Merlin 61 into it, which has a horsepower of 1,565 compared with the 1,150 of the Allison. And it absolutely transforms it. And of course, the Merlin 61 is now in Spitfire 9s, which are just emerging in 1943 and can outperform the latest 109 and Fokker Wolf 190. So it's absolutely, you know, it's clearly worth the punt. And it absolutely transforms it. It's kind of interesting because there's nothing wrong with the Spitfire 9 at all. The Spitfire is you know, known as the pilot's ultimate Spitfire and the ultimate fighter plane of the Spitfire marks. And it's perfectly capable of doing extreme mileage. It's just that the RAF have not pursued this. The Spitfire would have been every bit as good as a Mustang as a long range fighter. It's just they don't.
It's interesting you say that because our dear friend Joe Coles at Hushkit, there is a long article about, you know, what you would get turning a Spitfire into a long range escort compared to
So what does he say? He says it would.
He says work. No, not really. And part of the interesting thing is that the Mustang, the way the Mustang's designed, it's, and Richard Grace talked about this, it's a much more stable aircraft than the Spitfire. The Spitfire's twitchy, so it's harder work to fly.
With drop tanks, or just generally?
Just in general, because it's a pursuit dogfighting aircraft that really the Mustang isn't really. It's a more stable aircraft, because as an escort plane, it's for flying long distances and then you turn up and you attack someone, and then you turn around and you fly home.
But its high wing loading means it's incredibly nimble.
Yeah, but
you know, it can flick roll faster than anything else, for example.
But it's more. But it's an easier fly than the Spitfire. Right. And Richard talked about this, that you know the fundamentals of it are quite different for that reason. And you still, even because one of the things with the Merlin on the and it's, you know, it's Packard Merlins, American made Packard Merlins as well, is that they cap it, don't they, on the Mustang? They aren't using the full horsepower even to get that performance out of it. That's what Richard told us. They're sort of capped by 10% or something.
So you're not straining the engine so much.
So it's more fuel efficient, full stop. Whereas the Spitfire, they're not doing that. So to get it to perform at altitude, at distance, is burning through more fuel anyway. So the Spitfire isn't actually as good a bet as the Mustang for this role.
But, no, I think that's a completely fair point. But by the summer of 1942, there are loads and loads and loads of Spitfire 9s.
Yeah.
And lots of Spitfires, all of which you could turn into. It might not be as good as the Mustang, but you still could turn it into a long-range fighter, should there be the willing to do so. Because drop tanks and internal tanks are not easy to kind of add. The drop tanks are not difficult to add at all. And there's been plenty of examples of Spitfires flying extreme long range, such as the photo reconnaissance Spitfires. And admittedly, they're not armed. But you know, it can be done, and you can fly off an aircraft carrier and get to Malta from one end of the, you know, from the western end of the Mediterranean to halfway down. So it's perfectly possible, but there is a singular unwillingness by the Commander-in-Chief of Fighter Command, who is my old friend Trafford Leigh Mallory, to do so. You know, he just finds reasons why you can't do it. And that's because he has always jealously guarded all his aircraft and doesn't like anyone else letting them out of his hands. And he's terrified that, you know, the Americans are going to hog all the Spits and so on. And you know, he's just, it reflects very badly on him and frankly reflects very badly on the Air Ministry and the RAF, that they're so unwilling to help at a time where this is so completely essential. There's a sort of closed doorness about the RAF in the summer of 1943 as the American Air Force is sort of hitting a crisis point. It feels decidedly lacking in collaborative spirit, which I think is, frankly, embarrassing thinking about
it. But it's the fighter end of the RAF.
Yes, fighter end of the RAF, definitely. Yeah. Not in the leadership, but you know, it's not a good look. Anyway, be that as it may, the Mustang has already been singled out by Ron Harker, who is great mates with Tommy Hitchcock, who's the assistant air attaché in London, and who is actually the model on which Scott Fitzgerald based Tom Buchanan in The Great Gatsby. So he's a bit of a dandy, he's a bit of a kind of, you know, man about town, all the rest of it. But he's also a very talented pilot, good friends with Ron Harker, and he absolutely signals straight away to the US, says, you need to do this, you need to get these Packard Merlins in the P-51. And too sweet, and they do. And what they discover is that with the Merlin, at 5,000 feet, it can fly 375 miles an hour. But at 10,000 feet, with this super, you know, amazing supercharger that it has on the Merlin 61 and indeed the Packard Merlin, it can fly at 400 miles an hour. At 20,000 feet, it can do 430 miles an hour. And at 35,000 feet, it can do 455 miles an hour, which is 70 miles an hour faster than any German fighter plane at this stage, above heights of 28,000 feet. And that's a huge advantage because, of course, you always want height, because when you've got height, you can manipulate yourself so the sun is behind you and you have the advantage of extra diving speed. So that's why you always want height. And it's suddenly transformed from being a kind of average aircraft or not very good aircraft to being an absolute game changer. The interesting thing about it is that it is, although this is all happening in October 1942, not October 1943, the potential to go long distance is not discovered or not kind of pursued until the summer of 1943. So kind of, you know, 9 months after the marriage of the Merlin with the Mustang.
But then along comes, I mean, the thing I love about the drop tank, you know, is it's made of paper.
Yep.
The Atlas Lace Paper Company. They do test it and
they've
realize
got one in the museum at Sidwell, actually. They've got
yeah,
one.
They have. Yeah.
And you can literally pick it up with one hand.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And they realise that it worked. And certainly for the outward journey, for the bit where you're not being bothered by the enemy, you know, you can keep up with the bomber stream without any problems whatsoever. It doesn't really affect the handling of the aircraft. And it'll get you as far as Berlin. I mean, I think that, yeah, you can just pick the thing up. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
They're made on a mould. It's layers and layers of paper. So it's like, it's like MDF or like a compressed cardboard thing. Layers and layers and layers and layers of paper made on a mold with a fuel resistant lacquer, three pieces stuck together. It's cured. It's pressure tested to 6 pounds per square inch. And they're given two coats of dope followed by two coats of aluminium paint. Ta-da! Problem solved. Let's get on with winning the Second World War.
Absolutely amazing. And except that it's not married with the Mustang until the summer of 1943. And what's really interesting is that Hap Arnold, the commander-in-chief of the US Army Air Force, gives this directive to his deputy, who is Lieutenant General Barney Giles, in June 1943. So this is before Schweinfurt won. And he says, within this next 6 months, you've got to get a fighter to protect our bombers. Whether you use an existing type or have to start from scratch is your problem. Get to work on this right away, because by January 44, I want fighter escort for all our bombers from UK into Germany. I mean, that's an instruction and a half, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Just get on with it.
6 months is a long time to turn that around, isn't it?
Fortunately, Robert A. Lovett, who is the United States Assistant Secretary of State for War, has already identified the long-range potential of the P-51.
Yeah.
It's he, a civvy, rather than Giles, the deputy of the commander of the USAAF,
yeah,
who comes up with the solution. So immediately, Lovett tells Giles this, and Giles flies over to North American in California, who produces the Mustang, and first of all insists on trying to put 100 tank gallon behind the pilot, and, you know, Edgar Schmoot's a bit kind of dubious about this, but it flies absolutely fine. Then they add two bulletproof larger tanks in the wings, and they, again, you know, they're kind of, well, I'm not sure it's going to be able to cope with this, but it does.
That's the thing a Spitfire doesn't have room for. This is one of the things.
All of which is true. That is true.
Yeah, because the Mustang airframe is a sort of boxier, bulkier prospect, yep, yep, in a way.
Thicker wings.
Been designed. And then they go for two drop tanks as well, these paper marvels.
75 gallon each.
Yeah.
B-51 takes off, no problem at all. And suddenly you've got your game changer, because suddenly this can fly 1,474 miles, which is enough to take from Suffolk in the East Anglia in England all the way to Warsaw and back, let alone Berlin. So, you know, it is a game changer. I mean, there's no question that missed opportunities have been missed before then. You know, this is a problem that could have been solved a lot earlier. But, you know, it's not as though the Allies haven't got other things to think about and a lot on their plate and all the rest of it. So one should.
But these Mustangs start to arrive by November of 43. The 354th have been equipped with P-51Bs. I think the Mustang in people's mind is the one with the bubble canopy, with the, you know, the teardrop canopy, which is the D, isn't it? They still have an inline canopy with the fuselage.
Yeah, but in all other respects, it's exactly the same.
Yeah, yeah. But they're arriving and they're turning up. Blakesley then goes, well, where are my P-51s for the 4th Fighter Group?
Yeah, no, he's furious about it. But obviously, it makes sense to, you know, what you don't want to be doing is, what, I mean, the thinking behind it is that you don't want the time lag of a fighter group having to change over and switch aircraft and train and all the rest of it. So much better to send a fully formed brand new fighter group over with them, which is what the 354th is. But hilariously, they send Blakesley straight over to Boxted, where they're based in Suffolk, to kind of lick them into shape. And first of all, he gives them a kind of, but he just turns up, jumps out of his plane, doesn't say anything, just growls at them, and then calls them all into the kind of, you know, the operations room and gives them a briefing and gives them some sort of basic tactical advice. He says you need to be aggressive and fast at all time, and you should never, ever, ever turn away from a head-on attack. So one of the pilots puts up, of the 350 puts hands up and says, you know, what happens if the enemy proves as bullheaded? In that case, son, you'll have earned your extra flight and pay. He's just brilliant.
And the P-51s start to make a big difference, don't they? So yeah, so they're really flying their first sorties with them, and, you know, the pilots love them and are clamoring to fly every mission because they just love these planes so much. So in the 356, Captain Dick Turner has to set up a rotor to give pilots a fair play chance of flying. I mean, you can contrast the morale in the fighter groups, the fighter
amazing,
wings,
isn't it?
It's extraordinary. So the scene is set. They have the aircraft. They have the means to escort the bombers into the heart of the Reich. They have the plan is that they're going to destroy the Luftwaffe, and fighter production is the locus of its execution. So that is our next episode.
Yeah, and the cliffhanger at the end of 1943 is they've now got the solution. They've now got the first aircraft of this solution in theater. It's just, will there be, is there still enough time to do what they need to do before
Operation
Overlord, the cross-channel invasion? Yeah, yeah. And that's the million-dollar question. I think we should end it on that note. So long.
So long, Jim.
Yeah, so long, Al. Yeah, hey, take it easy.
Bye. Before we descend into ridiculous cartoonish voices, there are two ways you can listen to the rest of this series and, in fact, delve deep into our extensive, gigantic back catalogue of series and topics and all that sort of stuff, which is to search for us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe to our channel. That's right. We got ourselves a channel on Apple Podcasts and where everything's anthologized and curated for your ease of navigation for finding other subjects. But also what you get to do is jump the queue. You're not going to wait till next week for the rest of this. Or you can go to our Patreon, patreon.com/wehaveways, where the same thing is on offer, but more news of what we're up to, debate and discussion amongst our listeners, all sorts of stuff, and a live cast that we do every couple of weeks where Jim and I, you get the chance to watch us doing this, sat in our respective man caves discussing the Second World War and all its ramifications. I think the thing that's really striking me from talking about this is how powerful ideology can be. Which is a little, when you think about it, that is the story of the Second World War. It's like, where does ideology take you? And it, in this case, it took the 8th Air Force to the edge of a cliff, didn't it?
Yeah.
Basically.
It's just such a fascinating story, though, isn't it? I mean, we said when we started, this is not a straight line. It's twists and turns and jeopardy and cliffhangers and edges of precipices and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it really, really is.
It's evasive action. It's an engine on fire, starboard outer engine on fire. It's the whole
all that. And it's got amazing characters in it. It's just, it's such a fantastic story.
Okay, so we'll see you next time. Cheerio. Howdy doody.
Cheerio.
Goodbye.
Farewell.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.